Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Rivalry is at the heart of some of the most famous and fruitful relationships in history. In The Art of Rivalry, Four Friendships, Betrayals, and Breakthroughs in Modern Art, Sebastian Smee tells the fascinating story of four pairs of artists, Edouard Manet and Edgar Degas, Pablo Picasso and Henri Matisse, Jackson Pollock and Willem de Kooning, Lucian Freud and Francis Bacon, whose fraught competitive friendships spurred them to new creative heights. The Art of Rivalry follows these eight celebrated artists, each linked to a counterpart by friendship, admiration, envy, and ambition. In this lecture, held on December 4th, 2016 at the National Gallery of Art, Smee explores how coming into one's own as an artist, finding one's voice, almost always involves willfully breaking away from some intimate expectations of who you are or ought to be.
I thought that I would talk today about, as you can see, about Manet and Degas. There are four chapters in my book. Each tells the story of the crucial sort of breakthrough years for the artists involved in each case. The others are Lucian Freud and Francis Bacon, Matisse and Picasso, and de Kooning and Pollock. But just because, there are great works by all those artists in this gallery, but I thought that there are particularly great ones by Manet and Degas and many of them, and so I thought that that might be a great story to tell, or a story to tell anyway. I'll leave for you to decide. But it's really lovely to be here, as I said. When Edgar Degas died, a lonely, blind old man, who'd systematically alienated almost all his friends, people were astonished to find out about the extent of his own private collection of art. This collection had been assembled mostly in the 1890s, when Degas' finances had finally stabilized. He acquired scores of paintings and drawings by his heroes from earlier in the 19th century, Delacroix, Ingres, and Daumier. He bought works, too, by members of the younger generation, including Cézanne, Gauguin, and Mary Cassatt. He had a terrific collection of Japanese prints, and he also had an extraordinary trove of works by his great friend and rival, Edouard Manet. Collecting during this period quickly became an obsession for Degas. For a while, in fact, he even planned to create his own museum. That never happened, and instead, during the long later years of his life, he turned inward. When he died 20 years later, toward the end of the First World War, his astonishing collection was a rumor at most. Hardly anyone had seen it for years. So when it came on the market, it was huge news in the art world. The event of the season is how one journal described the series of three sales held in Paris in March and November of 1918, and the four more devoted to dispersing Degas' own works, the ones that were still in his studio when he died. To handle these seven auctions in all, the three biggest art dealers in Paris were called on. Wealthy American collectors like Louisine Havemeyer, and institutions like the Met in New York sent bidding instructions across the Atlantic to their agents in Paris. The Louvre was obviously a heavyweight contender, all the more so because the overwhelming majority of the artists Degas collected were French. And yet, in the event, the most substantial share of the collection went to London. How this happened is in itself a great story. Basically, and by the way, this probably the best version of this story, which I've read in various places, is told in an essay by James Fenton. You can find it in his collection, Leonardo's Nephew. But it was all thanks to Bloomsbury, that extraordinary and incestuous circle of English writers, artists, art critics, and biographers. Every group of creatives, of course, needs someone who knows about money. In Bloomsbury's case, they were lucky to have not just some random accountant who was willing to take a painting or perhaps a signed book in return for his services, but rather one of the most celebrated economists of the 20th century, John Maynard Keynes. Keynes is renowned as a theoretician, the father of Keynesian economics, but he was also a very pragmatic man, and a brave one too. He'd been convinced of the quality of the Degas collection by the artists Vanessa Bell and Duncan Grant, and by the critic Roger Fry. Bell was Virginia Woolf's sister, of course, and they were all intimate members of the Bloomsbury set. Fry had shown the catalogue to Sir Charles Holmes, the director of London's National Gallery. The gallery had been pretty much stripped of its funding because of the war, which was now in its fourth year. Keynes was working at the British Treasury, and he had a bright idea. The British government had an agreement at the time with its allies, the French. It allowed them to offset British spending in France against their already huge loans to the French government. France was struggling to pay even the interest on these loans. So Keynes, aware that his own National Gallery had no money to spend, argued that it made sense for some of the payments to be converted into pictures. The French government, according to his plan, would give the British Embassy a credit of £20,000, which Holmes could then spend at the auctions in Paris. The French, needless to say, were not in a position to say no. Now, obviously, going to Paris at that moment for any reason, let alone to buy a whole bunch of art, was risky. The Russians had recently withdrawn from the war. They were dealing with a rather significant revolution of their own at home. And this had freed the German army to concentrate on the Western Front. They were now advancing on Paris. And by the time of the first Degas auctions, their heavy guns, the infamous Big Berthas, were within range of the city. In fact, just a couple of days before the sale, the house right next to the gallery holding all the work was shelled and destroyed. That's how close Degas' collection came to being, not just dispersed, but completely destroyed. A conference for Allied governments had been scheduled in Paris for the same time as the sales. Keynes had to go to that, or at least it gave him some cover. And so he brought Holmes, the National Gallery director, along with him. He didn't want their mission known by anyone, so just for good measure, Keynes shaved off his mustache and put on a pair of spectacles. He caught the train from Charing Cross, and as the two men crossed the channel by ferry, they were escorted by an airship overhead and a destroyer alongside, perhaps less than subtle. In France, the train went through Amiens, not far from where Allied troops were being pushed back from their trenches near the Somme. They made it to Paris and thence to the auction. An hour into the proceedings, the Germans started shelling the city. Naturally, the bombs, which everyone could hear, increased the tension in the auction room. But they had one beneficial effect for Keynes and Holmes, which was to thin out the competition. There was quite a considerable rush to the door, wrote Holmes in his diary. He and Keynes stayed the course, and it was in this way that Holmes was able to acquire many pieces for the National Gallery at very low prices. One of the pieces he was able to buy was Manet's The Execution of Maximilian. You all may know it. There are four versions of it. One of them is in the National Gallery in London, and the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, where I live, has another earlier version, in fact, the earliest version. When French forces took the capital of Mexico City, from Republican forces led by Benito Juarez, they installed Maximilian, the idealistic younger brother of the Emperor of Austria, as the new Emperor of Mexico. Napoleon III assured Maximilian of his support and also the support of the Mexican population. But that support never congealed. And when things became dicey, Napoleon III withdrew French troops, telling Maximilian not to worry. This was bad advice, as he soon realized. So he counseled Maximilian at that point to abdicate. Maximilian, who had introduced many reforms during his brief rule, including debt relief for the poor and the abolition of corporal punishment, refused. With American help, Juarez and his Republican army retook the capital, and Maximilian, flanked by two of his generals, was executed. The news quickly reached France. Manet was a Republican. He detested Napoleon III, and so he was inspired to make a painting. His artistic source was Goya's famous execution scene, the 3rd of May, 1808, which he'd seen at the Prado, but his more immediate documentary sources were newspaper reports. Now, representing the execution itself was not like painting a fabled episode from ancient history or the Bible, which was what most artists at the time were tending to do. This was current affairs. It was, in a sense, like journalism, except, of course, that Manet himself wasn't there, and his task was made difficult by the fact that there were so many shifting accounts of what had actually happened. His decision to paint this fraught subject was clearly and consciously political. It was almost like choosing to show footage of the hanging of Saddam Hussein or the chaotic capture of Colonel Gaddafi in Libya, but in this case, in a context of heavy government censorship. Just how chaotic was Maximilian's execution? Well, it was pretty horrific. In the painting, there is a figure on the right who's not among the soldiers who are actually firing their rifles. He's facing us. He was the non-commissioned officer. His job was to finish off the victims if the firing squad's first volley left anyone still kicking. And as it happened, his services were required. When the smoke from the initial fusillade cleared, two of the victims, including Maximilian, were still alive. One of his two generals had not even been felled. Even as he stood there, in a macabre upright limbo, he had to wait to receive a fatal shot in the ear. And then they still had to deal with Maximilian. The emperor had fallen to the ground, but he was still twitching with life. Standing directly over him, the NCO fired again. But the flames from the misdirected shot ignited his vest. Water had to be fetched to extinguish them. Some say two more attempts failed because the rifles misfired. In a state of deep distress, the NCO finally succeeded, and at last it was over. The painting caused Manet endless difficulties, perhaps in part because he realized he was inviting trouble. He made four different versions, six if you include the etching and the lithograph. And of course, in the end, as Manet must have foreseen, the painting and the lithograph were censored. So all in all, it was a bitter experience. What a misfortune, wrote his wife Suzanne after his death, that Edouard labored so stubbornly on that. How many beautiful things he might have painted during all that time instead. Now, it so happens that as he was working on the Maximilian paintings in 1868, Manet was also posing with Suzanne for a picture by Degas. The picture was a double portrait, and in a sense, therefore, a portrait of their marriage. Degas had been planning it for quite a while. He chose to show Manet reclining indolently on a couch, while Suzanne, a gifted musician, played on the piano. After Degas finished the double portrait, he presented it to Manet and Suzanne as a gift. A short time later, he came to visit Manet, and what he saw was that his painting had been slashed. The knife had gone right through the face and figure of Suzanne. And the culprit, as Degas quickly discovered, the vandal, was Manet. What's important to note here is that Manet had had a bigger and more profound influence on Degas than anyone else. And that influence was not only artistic, but personal too. They'd met at the Louvre in 1861. Degas was making an etching in front of a painting then believed to be by Velázquez. Manet, who loved Velázquez and all things Spanish and who was heavily into etching at that time, walked over to him and was cheeky enough to offer up a bit of advice. Degas, who was proud and could be prickly, and I love this self-portrait just because it's in the Clark Art Institute in Williamstown. It's one of many early self-portraits, but it gives us a particular idea, I think, of that pride and prickliness. But despite that, he responded warmly and gratefully, and their friendship was up and running. At that time, Manet was riding high. He was 29. He had just exhibited a painting, The Spanish Singer, at the annual Salon. And that's my poor cell phone photo, but many of you may know that as well. It's in the Met. And it had made a big impression. It was his first public success. Recognizing something fresh and full of promise, a group of young painters and critics had made a special pilgrimage to Manet's studio to salute him. Degas, who was 2 years younger, was at a less advanced stage in his career. Both he and Manet were from well-born families. Both their fathers had expected them to go into the law, but both had plumbed for art instead. Degas' father was disappointed, but he liked art. He was knowledgeable about it. And he eventually arranged for Degas to undergo a good academic training in the neoclassical tradition. When he met Manet, Degas was involved in a terrible struggle to synthesize this neoclassical training, and specifically the influence of Ingres. This is an Ingres study that's in the Harvard Art Museums, with his growing interest in the romanticism of Delacroix, and indeed the realism of Courbet. This is a Delacroix, of course. He was working on big canvases, and he was illustrating rather obscure episodes from ancient history and mythology, and making very little headway. His family despaired about whether he would ever finish anything. And then he met Manet, who slapped vivid colors straight onto the canvas in large, brushy blocks, no painstaking buildup from darker layers to light. Manet, who favored frontally lit subjects, which flattened them out further, and free handling in the manner of Fransals or Delacroix. Let's see if, yeah, there's another photo of mine, but a lovely Fransals. Manet, who loved rich blacks that set off an otherwise light palette, disregarding intermediary tones. Manet, the most congenial of men, the epitome of the mid-century flaneur, charm incarnate. You felt that everything he painted, he loved. And in this very nonchalance, there was something not just erotic, but briskly violent, as if one way of thinking of love were as a kind of glancing blow. Manet never seemed to envy the success of his fellow artists. He always approves, said his friend Fantin-Latour, of the painting of the people he likes. And it seems he liked Degas. Degas, as I said, was prickly and fiercely independent. He was not someone who was prone to falling under anyone's spell. And yet, for a while there in the early 1860s, he clearly fell under Manet's spell. And so, having spent years stuck in his studio, working and reworking large, stilted canvases, none of which seemed to quite work out, he now began to loosen up. He embraced a brushier, less finished style, and following Manet, he took to people's private homes and eventually to the streets, the racetrack, and the ballet, and generally started paying attention to contemporary life. He relaxed his strenuous attempts to marry the romanticism of Delacroix with the neoclassicism of Ingres, and turned instead to his own version of realism, and especially to portraits of family members and acquaintances in intimate settings. Now, of course, almost everyone knows what happened to Manet in the 1860s. He exhibited first the Luncheon on the Grass and then Olympia. These and several other paintings that he submitted to the Salon, sometimes successfully but more often not, were savaged by the critics and laughed at by the public. It's all a tired cliché today, the infamous scandals at the Salon. But when you look back at what actually happened, at all the terrible things that were said about Manet, his ineptitude, his clumsiness, his poor taste, his depravity, it's hard to believe. Today we regard the 1860s as Manet's great decade, the decade that saw him produce the majority of his most famous and audacious pictures. But it was also a period of steadily increasing pressure and truly demoralizing setbacks. Each year, Manet marshaled his resources, planned his approach, and sent his finest pictures to the Salon. And each year, he was either spurned by the jury or subjected to the humiliating white heat of public contempt. There was no 19th century painter who was so relentlessly and brutally battered by criticism. And for a man who craved public approval and yearned for official honors as he did, the experience was almost crushing. The attacks directed against me, he later confessed, broke in me the mainspring of life. No one knows what it is to be constantly insulted. It disheartens you and undoes you. By the time Degas came to paint the portrait of Manet's marriage, Manet had lapsed into a sustained period of gloom and dismay. Usually prolific, he painted barely more than a dozen pictures over the following 2 years. At times like this, of course, friends matter. Manet had many friends, and one of them was Degas. But what sort of a friend was he? He was complicated. On the one hand, Manet might have been tempted to think of him as a kind of protege, someone he, Manet, had influenced. And this was true. If nothing else, it would have been good for Manet's ego to register it. The dynamic had been uneven from the beginning, when Manet, riding high from his success with the Spanish singer, had presumed to give Degas advice. And yet, on the other hand, Degas was no one's follower. He was too ambitious and too solitary. He had certain advantages, too. He was clearly a better draftsman than Manet. Temperamentally, what's more, he was made of sterner stuff. He had a steely, determined nature. Manet, it seems, was slightly more fragile. And so, by about 1865, you begin to sense that Degas, feeling himself perhaps too much enthralled to Manet, wants to push back a little, to find ways of carving out his own identity. Now, since Degas' portrait of Manet was the portrait of a marriage, it's worth spending a moment here on Degas' actual feelings about marriage, and on the rather unusual nature of Manet's particular marriage. A lifelong bachelor, Degas seemed to stare at the marriages he knew with a kind of dismay. Part of him envied those who seemed to have found happiness in marriage. But at the age of 35, he already struck one friend as, quote, an old bachelor embittered by hidden disappointments. He had a gift for sniffing out disharmony and tensions between the sexes, and an obsession with capturing those tensions on canvas. In one early painting after another, most notably in Young Spartans Exercising and Scenes of War in the Middle Ages and the ominous picture known simply as Interior, a woman or group of females on the left is placed in an antagonistic relationship with a man or group of males on the right. By the end of the 1860s, when he came to paint Manet and Suzanne, a specific preoccupation not just with conflict between the sexes, but with marriage itself, was rising to a kind of crescendo in his work. He seems to have believed that it was virtually impossible to be both a serious artist and married at the same time. And of course, this attitude was typical among male painters of his time. A married man is a reactionary, Courbet said. Delacroix, too, became agitated when a young painter told him of his plans to marry. And if you love her and if she's pretty, that's the worst of all, he said. Your art is dead. An artist should know no other passion than his work and sacrifice everything to it. Degas took all this kind of thinking to heart. He was persistently patronizing toward the category of wives in general. About his choice to remain a bachelor, he explained, I was too afraid that after I'd finished a picture, I would hear my wife say, what you've done there is very pretty indeed. His later friendship with Mary Cassatt was boosted tremendously, one senses, by his admiration for her decision not to marry. Degas seemed to have liked Suzanne Manet, but one can't help feeling that his feelings about marriage in general somehow played into his attitude towards Manet's marriage to her. And it was, as I said, a rather peculiar marriage. Suzanne Lernhof was a Dutch piano player who'd been employed by Manet's parents to teach their sons piano. She was a few years older than Manet, and she was a very good musician. But before Manet was even 20, they both departed from the curriculum, and Manet was receiving an education rather different from the one his parents had in mind. And before long, Suzanne was pregnant. This was a disaster for Manet's family. His father was a high court judge. And not just that, he routinely oversaw paternity cases. The potential for embarrassment, and worse than embarrassment, because codes among the upper bourgeoisie were very strict, was acute. Once his mother had learned of Suzanne's pregnancy, she took control of the situation. She sent for Suzanne's mother, who came over from Holland, and set herself and Suzanne up in an apartment. When the boy, Leon, was born, he was described to outsiders as Suzanne's youngest brother. Manet was made his godfather. And so for many years, until after the death of Manet's father, Manet shuttled back and forth between his own home and Suzanne and Leon's apartment. He lived, in other words, a double life, a secret life, not so much by choice as by necessity. Even after he married Suzanne, 10 years after Leon's birth, they had to wait until Manet's father, the High Court judge, died. Leon's paternity was kept under wraps. So there was a secret at the very center of Manet's private life, one that needed to be protected. How this affected him in the long term, we can only guess, but it seems certain that it contributed to a pressure, a tension that lay not far beneath the breezy surface of his work. It was a pressure Degas only gradually became aware of, but he had a nose for secrets, and I think he was fascinated by the dynamic of Manet's marriage to Suzanne. Manet's style, and really his view of what it meant to be modern, was all about the play of surfaces and sensuality. He may have been drawn to contemporary subjects, but he was no documentarian. Instead, like his friend Baudelaire, he cultivated an idea of Paris as a locale of masks and mystery, an incessant spur to the imagination, a place that changed, as Baudelaire wrote, quote, faster, alas, than the human heart. Baudelaire's understanding of the modern was not cool and detached in the early 20th century manner. It was personal, provisional, and erotic. The key words in the poet's lexicon, languid, idle, furtive, secret, private, all found equivalents in Manet's signature motifs. The black cat, the bunch of flowers, the black ribbon, the cascading dress, the half-peeled orange, the fan, and the blank, unrevealing face. Manet believed in keeping secrets. That's perhaps why almost all the faces of his subjects are more or less blank. He and Degas both connected modern urban life with flux and instability. But for Manet, the whole point was the charade itself, the play of disguises, the apprehension, as Edgar Allan Poe once put it, that there is such a thing as being too profound. His most famous pictures reflect the part of his personality that liked, quote, to be lighthearted, enamored of all the most obvious things in life, and wanting no complications. For his letterhead, he chose an appropriately unblinking motto, everything happens. Manet's insistence on surface values and personal whim has contributed to the feeling that his pictures are willfully opaque. Seldom has a great painter produced so many bizarre anomalies, head-spinning combinations of inappropriate clothing or lack of clothing, strange mashups of genre, head-spinning combinations of contemporary realism and allusions to art history. Their mysteries are legion. But these mysteries sit on the surface and, in a strange sort of way, almost don't matter. What really matters, what they exude instead, is a sense of the pleasure of their own making. Degas may have admired aspects of all this. He surely envied them. But he didn't necessarily buy it. He was interested in uncovering secrets. He became fascinated around 1865 in physiognomy, the idea that you can tell things about a person's character or social status or mental life by looking at their faces. And he made more and more portraits that expressed what he thought of as modern psychological states. This is Manet's portrait of Victorine Meurent, the same model who sat for the Luncheon on the Grass and Olympia. And like I was saying before, most of his portraits are fairly blank-faced. Here is Degas. And this is really the first example of his switch to a more modern kind of portraiture. Degas was very competitive with writers, and he wanted his paintings in the 1860s to have the psychological depth of 19th century novels. And so he liked painting people in states that were unselfconscious, while they were listening to music, for instance. His idea was that people will reveal more about themselves when they are not consciously presenting themselves, when they have, so to speak, forgotten themselves. All this reminds us that Degas was predisposed to see art in ethical terms, as an endeavor requiring both courage and sobriety. And he'd begun to feel, I suspect, that Manet's approach resulted in a kind of moral thinness. Degas had little time for whimsy and a fundamental impatience with illusions. He believed that art must be in service to truth. His job was to reveal that truth, to catch it unawares, to ambush it. In this sense, there was something almost predatory about the way Degas painted. You have to paint a painting as you would commit a crime, he once said. Despite these differences, Degas and Manet were becoming closer and closer toward the end of the 1860s. They were good friends. They saw each other a couple of nights a week at the Café Gabois, where the so-called Batignolles group of artists and writers convened to talk and play billiards. And they attended weekly soirees together at the apartments of Manet's mother, or Degas' father, or the painter Alfred Stevens, or at a number of other private homes. The setting Degas chose for his portrait was a third-floor apartment in the Batignolles district. It was here that Manet and Suzanne lived, together with Léon, who was now a teenager, working as a runner for Degas' father's bank, in fact, and Manet's widowed mother. Suzanne, as I said, was an excellent pianist. When guests attended the Manet's regular Thursday evening soirees, to which Degas had a standing invitation, she would play for them. So it was fitting that Degas chose to portray her at the keyboard. This, by the way, just is Léon, the son. This is from just a couple of years later, 1870, after the Franco-Prussian War and the Commune. And that's Suzanne on the left. They've moved to the seaside just after all that terrible conflict. But we're talking about this picture here that we saw at the beginning. We don't know how long the sittings took. We don't know if Suzanne actually played while Degas was painting, or if she did what she played. But we do know that when he had finished the picture, Degas, justly proud of his efforts, presented it to Manet. Sometime later, he paid a visit to Manet's studio. And when he spied his finished painting, he immediately saw that something was wrong. Someone, as I said, had taken a knife to it, and the blade had gone right through Suzanne's face and body. And the culprit, as Degas presently discovered, was Manet. In response, Degas chose simply to leave. Without saying goodbye, he later recalled, and taking my picture with me. Back home, Degas took down the little still life Manet had given him after a dinner party at which Degas had broken a salad bowl. He had it wrapped and sent it back with a note that, according to Vollard, the dealer, said, "Monsieur, I am returning your plums." There's debate as to whether the still life actually showed plums or was in fact a picture of walnuts in a bowl, but we can put that aside for now. The story that Vollard spread is that Manet was angry at Degas' portrayal of Suzanne, that it was an unflattering portrayal, and that's why he'd cut it. This may be right, or almost right, but it's always struck me as rather unconvincing. My suspicion is that what really irked Manet about Degas' portrait of his marriage was not perhaps anything as tepid or as literal as Degas' supposed failure to flatter Suzanne. It was more likely the culmination of a gathering threat. And this can happen between rivals, even those who are close friends. Degas, it seems fair to surmise, was getting too close to Manet's marriage and to the secrets it veiled. If the portrait of Manet and Suzanne subtly expressed some of Degas' negative feelings about marriage in general, they may also have expressed a judgment on Manet's marriage in particular. With cool deliberation, Degas had depicted Suzanne absorbed in her music making, facing away from her disaffected husband, who's off in his own world, dreaming, one could infer, of the work he should be getting on with. Or of someone else, of Bert Morisot, perhaps, the wonderful painter who had lately come into the circle of Manet and Degas. This is not Bert Morisot, but it's a painting by her, a beautiful one, not far away from here in Richmond. Morisot was clearly in love with Manet at this time, and Manet himself seems to have been more than a little bit keen on her. Manet's lashing out at the picture may have been motivated then by anger at Degas' unwanted intrusion into the delicate and frustrating situation with Morisot. There's much more to that situation. It's a rather soap opera-ish kind of story, but basically, Degas had come to know too much about Manet. He was too perceptive. He loomed too large in his life. Manet's outburst may also have been fueled by the underlying suspicion, that Degas was no longer either protege or friend, but a genuine rival, a threat, someone who was thriving, even as he, Manet, was sinking into a quagmire. And then, of course, there's the possibility that Manet's anger may have been stoked simply by marital frustration. Degas' portrait seemed to be reminding him, perhaps, of something dismal, something hastily cobbled together and vaguely shaming about his union with Suzanne. In the midst of his creative slump and of his thwarted infatuation with Morisot, Manet may well have entertained a growing suspicion that Degas' bias against marriage was in some way justified. Wouldn't he may have wondered, have had a freer hand to create and invent and generally do as he pleased if he didn't have to maintain the front of his marriage to Suzanne? Beyond even this, I think, and with perhaps greater implications for the future paths of modernism, there was the fact that Degas' eye, his way of looking, although more and more artistically compelling, was so mercilessly detached and analytical. Degas dissected the world in front of him. Rather than seeing relations intuitively and whole, enhanced by feeling and imagination, as Manet saw the world, he pulled things apart, the better to see what they were made of. But in the process, he tore at the invisible threads that connected them. Staring at Degas' portrait of his marriage, Manet might have seen the distinction between his own view of the world and Degas' etched more starkly than ever, and found it, however briefly, intolerable. Degas went about trying to repair the picture, attaching a new section of canvas to the right side where Suzanne's face and the piano had been, but he never got around to repainting it. If you travel to a mid-sized industrial port in Japan on the southernmost island of Kyushu, you can still see the picture today hanging in the same state he left it. The incident had caused a serious rift, unsurprisingly, in the friendship between the two artists. And although they made a late up, things were never quite the same between them. Manet died 10 years later. Degas outlived him by 34 years. Collecting is, in a way, a sublimating activity, a way of turning pleasure into control, chaos into order. It's also, at times, a method by which to repair, restore, and retrieve. Degas, as I said, remained a bachelor all his life, just 18 months after Manet died, and still more than 30 years before his own death. He wrote to a friend saying, quote, "Fundamentally, I don't have much affection, and what I once had hasn't been increased by family and other troubles. I've been left only with what couldn't be taken from me. Not much. Thus speaks a man who wants to finish his life and die all alone, with no happiness whatsoever." Unquote. Degas' collection was a big part of what he felt couldn't be taken from him. But of course it could, and when he died, it was. The pictures by Manet in this collection tell a particularly interesting story. Many of the Manet images, which amount to 8 paintings, 14 drawings, and more than 60 prints, depict people who had played central roles in Manet's world. It was a world to which Degas, for a time, had special access, but it was also a world from which he seems to have felt slightly excluded. One of the paintings, as I've already said, was the version of the execution of Maximilian that has ended up in London, thanks to Keynes. Like Degas' picture of Manet and Suzanne, it's not whole. It seems to be in 3 separate sections, each glued onto a bigger piece of empty canvas. So you may wonder, did someone take a knife to this picture too? And in fact, someone did, but it wasn't a revenge attack by Degas. This time, there were 2 culprits. One of them was, once again, Manet. The other, years later, after his death, was his son, Léon. Exactly why Manet removed most of the figure of Maximilian and all of his fellow victim, a Mexican general, we don't know. But we do know that Manet's family thought he'd wasted a lot of good time on this unsellable picture, and that after his death, they put it in storage and let it deteriorate. After many years had gone by, Léon retrieved the canvas and sliced it up some more. He sold the central part, the massed firing squad, to the dealer Vollard. Léon had earlier sold one of the other fragments to Degas. Now, by happenstance, Vollard and Degas both sent their separate fragments of the canvas to the same restorer. That restorer showed Vollard the Degas-owned fragment, and Vollard went to tell Degas that he owned the other fragment. Degas was furious. He sent Vollard back to Léon and told him to retrieve the other pieces. He then did his best to put them back together. The result is the partially rehabilitated canvas that now hangs in London. And when Degas showed it in its patched together, incomplete state to visitors, he would mutter, "Again, the family. Beware of the family." Thank you very much indeed.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.